them. Deep cover notwithstanding, Josh revealed himself to be conspicuously American by asking the bartender for beer. He wound up settling for a Pimm's cup, which he consumed with an air of disappointed bafflement. But he and Poppy made themselves agreeable to the other guests with an ease and skill that Quentin found awe-inspiring. Genuinely social people never ceased to amaze him. Their brains seemed to generate an inexhaustible fund of things to say, naturally, with no effort, out of nothing at all. It was a trick Quentin had never figured out. As an unattached American male among English strangers, he felt inherently suspicious. He did his best to affiliate himself with small groups and nod along politely in response to people who weren't especially talking to him. Julia found a wall to put her slender back against and looked decorously mysterious. Only one man dared to approach her, a tall Cantabrigian type with a half-grown beard, and she sent him packing in terms so uncertain he had to salve his wounds with a cucumber sandwich. After a half hour of this, Quentin felt he could begin a slow drift toward the stairs, not the grand Terra-style ones in front, but a more unassuming, utilitarian staircase toward the back of the house. One by one, he caught the other's eyes in turn and inclined his head. "We were just looking for a bathroom, all four of us. Too bad they didn't have drugs. That would have made a better cover story." The staircase performed a tight switchback up to the second floor, a hushed and darkened maze of white walls and parquet. The rumble and tinkle of the party was still clearly audible, but hushed now, like distant surf. There were a few kids up here, helling along the hallways and racketing in and out of rooms, laughing a little too hysterically, playing some game nobody knew the rules of, flopping down on the coats when they got tired, the kind of forced pack of one-shot friends that exists on the margins of all grown-up parties. The world in the walls wasn't a how-to manual, and it was irritatingly vague as to the precise location of the famous clock. "One of the back corridors of one of the upper floors," was all the detail Plover gave them. Maybe it would have been better to split up, except that would have violated the basic teaching of every movie ever made. Quentin would have worried that everybody else would slip through into Fillory without him, leaving him behind in reality, like the last man standing in a game of sardines. Whoever lived here now didn't use the top floor at all, and it had gone unrestored. Another piece of luck. They hadn't even refinished the floors. The varnish had worn off them, and the walls were old wallpaper, with even older wallpaper showing through in places. The ceilings were low. The rooms were full of mismatched and broken furniture under sheets. The quieter it got, the realer Fillory began to feel. It loomed in the shadows, under beds, behind the wallpaper, in the corner of his eye, just out of view. 10 minutes from now, they could be back on the Muntjac. This was the place. This was where the children played, where Martin vanished, where Jane watched, where the whole terrible fantasy began, and there in the hallway, the back hallway, as it had been written, as the prophecy foretold, stood a grandfather clock. It was a beast of a clock, with a big, fat, brass face orbited by four smaller dials, tracking the months and the phases of the moon and the signs of the zodiac and God knew what else, all framed in plain, uncarved, dark wood. The works must have been hellishly complex, the 18th-century equivalent of a supercomputer. The wood was the wood of a Fillorian sunset tree, it said in the book, which shed its flaming orange leaves every day at sundown, endured a leafless winter overnight, and then sprouted fresh green new ones at dawn. Quentin, Julia, Josh, and Poppy gathered around it. It was like they were reenacting a Fillory book. No, they were in one, a new one, and they were writing it together. The pendulum wasn't moving. Quentin wondered if the connection could still be live, or whether it had broken after the children went through. He couldn't feel anything. But it had to work. He would make it work. He was going back to Fillory if he had to cram himself into every fucking piece of cabinetry in his house. Even so, it was going to be a tight fit. Maybe if he'd breathed out all his air and wriggled through sideways. Not how he planned to make his triumphant return to Fillory, but at this point he'd take whatever worked. "Quentin," Josh said.
"Yeah."
"Quentin, look at me." He had to tear his eyes away from the clock. When he did, he found Josh watching him with a gravity that didn't suit him. It was a new Josh gravity.
"You know I'm not going, right?"
He did know. He just let himself forget in all the excitement. Things were different now. They weren't kids. Josh was part of a different story.
"Yeah," Quentin said. "I guess I do know.
Thanks for coming this far. What about you, Poppy? Chance of a lifetime."
"Thank you for asking me."
She seemed to mean it, to take it in the spirit in which it was offered. She put a hand on her chest.
"But I've got my whole life here. I can't go to Fillory."
Quentin looked at Julia, who'd taken off her shades in deference to the gloom of the top floor.
"Just you and me, kid."
Together, they stepped forward. Quentin got down on one knee. The roar of their imminent escape thundered in his ears. As soon as he got up close, he could see that it wasn't going to work. The thing wasn't ticking, but more than that, it just looked too solid. The clock was what it was and nothing more. It was brute, mundane matter, wood and metal. He turned the little knob and opened the glass case and looked in at the hanging pendulum and chimes and whatnot other brass hardware dangling there impotently. His heart had already gone out of it. It was dark in here. He reached in and rapped the back of the case with his knuckles. Nothing. He closed his eyes. "God damn it," he said. "Never mind. It wasn't over. They could always try climbing trees." Though at that moment he felt less like climbing a tree than he'd ever felt like doing anything in his entire life.
"You're doing it wrong, you know."
Their heads turned in unison. It was a little kid's voice, a boy. He was standing at the end of the corridor in his pajamas, watching them. He might have been 8 years old.
"What am I doing wrong?" Quentin said.
"You have to set it going first," the boy said. "It says in the book, but it doesn't work anymore. I tried it."
The boy had fine, tousled brown hair and blue eyes. A more quintessential English Moppet it would have been hard to find, right down to his having a spot of trouble pronouncing his L's and R's. He could have been cloned from Christopher Robin's toenail clippings.
"Mummy says she's going to send it to the shop, but she never does. I climbed the trees, too, and I did a painting. Lots of them, actually. Do you want to see?"
They stared at him. Not finding himself rebuffed, he walked over on bare feet. He had that dismal air of sprightly self-possession that some English children have. Just looking at him, you knew you were going to have to play a game with him.
"I even had Mummy pull me round in an old wagon we found in the garage."
He said it, garage.
"It's not the same as a bicycle, but I had to try it."
"I can see that," Quentin said. "I can see where you would have to do that."
"But we can keep looking there," he said. "I like it. My name's Thomas."
He actually held out his little paw for Quentin to shake, like a tiny alien ambassador. Poor kid, it wasn't his fault. He must be so chronically neglected by his parents that he had taken to press-ganging random party guests into paying attention to him. He made Quentin think of faraway Eleanor, the little girl on the outer island. The really awful thing was that Quentin was going to go along with it, and not for the right reasons. He took the proffered paw. It wasn't that he felt bad for Thomas, though he did. It was that Thomas was a valuable ally. Adults never got into Fillory by themselves, at least not without a magic button. It was always the kids. What Quentin needed, he realized, was a native guide to act as bait. Maybe if he let young Thomas here course along ahead of him, like a hound across the moors, he just might flush out a portal or two. He was going to use Thomas to chum the waters. "Just get me a drink," Quentin said to Josh as Thomas pulled him away. As they passed Poppy, Quentin firmly grabbed her hand. The misery train was leaving the station, and Quentin wasn't going to travel alone. It emerged, with remarkably little prompting from Quentin or Poppy, that Thomas's parents had bought the Chatwin house a couple of years ago from the children of Fiona Chatwin. Thomas and his parents were themselves, through some connection that Quentin couldn't follow, distantly related to Plover. Maybe that was where the money came from. Thomas had been simply mad with excitement when he heard the news. Weren't all his friends at school jealous? Of course, now he had all new friends, because before he'd been in London and now they were in Cornwall. But his friends here were much nicer, and he only missed London when he thought about the Rainforest Life exhibit at the zoo. Had Quentin ever been to the zoo in London? If he could choose, would he be an Asian lion or a Sumatran tiger? And did he know that there was a monkey called a red titty monkey? It wasn't rude. You could say it because it was a real kind of monkey. And didn't he agree that, under certain extreme circumstances, the murder of children was completely ethically justifiable? Towed by Thomas, the tank engine, they toured the grounds. As a threesome, they conducted a deep cavity search of the top floor, including closets and attics. They made 7 or 8 circuits of the enormous green behind the house, with special attention paid to rodent burrows and spooky trees and copses large enough for a human being to infiltrate. Meanwhile, Josh kept up an underground railroad of gin and tonics, handing them off to Quentin whenever he happened to pass by, like a spectator handing Gatorade to a marathoner. It could have been worse. The view from the back terrace was even grander than the front. An orderly English estate had been hacked out of the rough Cornish countryside by main force, including a flat, still swimming pool that by some landscaper's artifice had mostly escaped looking anachronistic. Beyond it, a perfect Constable vista rolled down and away, green hills and fallow hay fields and pocket villages all slowly dissolving in the viscous light of a golden English sunset. Thomas enjoyed the attention, and Poppy, he'd give her this, was a heroically good sport. She had no real stake in how all this turned out, but she pitched right in. She was nothing if not game. Moreover, she was better at it than he was, hardened as she was by many tours in the babysitting trenches. It all finished up, predictably, in Thomas's bedroom. By 10:30, even Thomas, with his titanically fresh-faced lust for life, couldn't be coaxed into one more round of fine fillery. They all sat or sprawled on the rainbow-colored, woolly yarn rug in Thomas's room. It was a huge room, a little kingdom, all Thomas's own. It even had an extra bed in it, in the shape of a space rocket, as if to cruelly emphasize Thomas's only childhood, the hilarious sleepovers he wasn't having. Josh and Julia joined them there. The party raged on beneath them into the night, having degenerated from a cocktail party into a regular party party. They should leave, obviously. At this point, Thomas had gone from harasser to harassed. Maybe Josh was right. Maybe they'd try Stonehenge next. But not before they'd burned this bridge right down to its charred pilings. So they played other games. They ground out rounds of Animal Snap and Rummy and Connect Four. They played board games, Cluedo and Monopoly and Mousetrap, until Thomas was too tired and they were too drunk to follow the rules. They dug deeper into Thomas's toy closet, and thus further back into Thomas's childhood, for games so mathematically simple they were barely games at all, lacking as they did almost any strategic element. War and Snakes and Ladders and Hi-Ho Cheerio and, finally, High Seas, a primally simple alphabet game in which the main goal seemed to be to win the pre-game argument with your fellow players over who got to be the dolphin. After that, everything else was blind chance and cartoon fish. Quentin took a slug of flat, warm gin and tonic. It tasted like defeat. This was how the dream died, in a welter of plastic, primary-colored board game pieces upstairs at a bad party. They would keep looking. They would knock on all the first doors they could think of, but for the first time, lying there sprawled on the spare bed, his long legs flat out, with his back against Thomas's rocket ship headboard, Quentin took seriously the possibility that he wasn't going back after all. Probably hundreds of years had gone by in Fillory anyway. The ruins of White Spire were dissolving in the rain, white stones softening like sugar cubes under green moss by a now nameless bay. The tombs of King Elliot and Queen Janet were probably long since overgrown with ivy, twin clock trees rising from their twin plots. Perhaps he was remembered as a legend, King Quentin the Missing, the once and future king, like King Arthur, except unlike Arthur, he wasn't coming back from Avalon, just the once king. Well, it was a fitting place to end it, in the Chatwin's house, where everything started. The first door. The really funny thing was that even though he'd hit bottom, he couldn't honestly say that it was all that bad there. He had his friends, or some of them. They had Josh's money. They still had magic and alcohol and sex and food. They had everything. He thought of Venice and the pure green Cornish landscape they'd just driven through. There was so much more to this world than he thought. What the hell did he have to complain about? Fuck all, was the answer. One day he'd have a house like this, too, and a kid like Thomas, who lay fast asleep with the lights on and his arms thrown up over his head, a marathon runner breaking the tape in his dreams. He and some lovely and talented Mrs. Quentin, who, Poppy? Surely not, would get married, and Fillory would fade away like the dream it so fundamentally was. So what if he wasn't a king? It had been lovely for a while, but here was real life, and he would make the most of it, like everybody else. What kind of a hero was he, if he couldn't do that? Julia kicked his foot. By unspoken agreement, they were all grimly determined to finish the game of high seas, and it was his turn. He flicked the spinner and moved forward two waves. Josh, who was playing as the whale, had a commanding lead, but Julia, the squid, was making a late charge, leaving Poppy, fish, and Quentin, jellyfish, to battle it out for a distant third place. Josh spun. He was on a charade square.
Caw!
Josh said.
Caw! Caw!
Seagull, they all said in unison. It was like when they were geese. Josh spun again. Julia belched. Quentin slumped over behind Poppy's warm back onto the infinitely soft and sweet-smelling pillows. From this point of view, it was apparent that Poppy was wearing a thong. The bed was not entirely stable. The drinks were catching up with him. It wasn't clear whether the spins were going to spin themselves out or gather speed and power and wreak a terrible vengeance upon him for his many transgressions. Well, time would undoubtedly tell.
"Caw!"
Josh said. "Enough already," Quentin said.
"Caw! Caw!"
"Seagull! I said seagull!" The light hurt his eyes. It was uncomfortably bright in Thomas's room. That was enough drinking for tonight. Quentin sat up.
"I know, man," Josh said. "I heard you."
"Caw!"
The cawing didn't stop. Nor did the spinning. The bed was definitely in motion, not so much spinning as rocking gently. They all froze. Poppy reacted first.
"No way!"
She lunged off the bed and landed in water.
"God damn it, no fucking way!"
The sun was hot overhead. A curious albatross was circling over them, making respectful inquiries. Quentin jumped up on the bed.
Oh, my God! We did it! We did it!
They had broken through. It wasn't the end. It was all about to start all over again. He spread his arms wide to the daylight and let the hot sun slam straight down into his face. He was a man reborn. Julia was looking around her and sobbing as though her heart would break. They were back. The dream was real again. They were adrift on the high seas of Fillory. Book 3. Chapter 17.
Thomas will be so disappointed,
Poppy said.
He missed everything.
She sat glumly on a sail locker on the deck of the Muntjac, wrapped in a rough ship's blanket. Her curly hair was flat from the salt water. She'd tried to swim away, back to Earth, back to Thomas's little boy bedroom. But when she saw that she had no shot, she stroked back to the bed instead, and they'd hauled her dripping back up onto it to await rescue. She was a strong, easy swimmer, which was somehow not surprising. The bed, while a top-quality bed that contained a fair amount of actual bona fide wood, Thomas's parents had spared no expense, was only so-so as a raft, and had trended downward rapidly as the bedclothes and then the mattress soaked through and lost their buoyancy. Josh sat heavily on it, crisscross applesauce, resigned. Buddha going down with the ship, while the bed gradually swamped and the cold seawater lapped up over his knees. But the Muntjac was already in view by then, shearing keenly through the waves toward them, the force of a fresh wind setting it at a rakish angle. Its sails, his sails, Quentin's sails, with the pale blue ram of Fillory, stood out in taut, proud curves. The power of it, the color, the solidity, the reality of it were almost too thrilling. A tiny action figure sailor was already at the railing, pointing in their direction. Quentin hadn't for a second doubted that the Muntjac would be there. It seemed like years since he'd seen it. They had come to take him home. As it bore down on them, he'd had a moment of worry. What if centuries had passed? What if Elliot and Janet really were dead, and the Muntjac was the last survivor of the Brakebills era, and he was going home to a court of strangers? But no, there was Bingle at the railing, looking just as he always had, ready to haul his royal body back on board and get back to guarding it. Though even as they were toweling off and hugging each other and making introductions and securing fresh clothes and hot tea, he could see that not everything aboard the Muntjac was exactly as he'd left it. The ship was older. Not that it was shabby, but it had aged, settled into itself some. What had been glossy, the paint on the railings, the varnish on the deck, was now rubbed to matte. Ropes that had once been bright and prickly were now smooth and soft and dun-colored from having been run through blocks over and over again. Also, Quentin was no longer in charge of the Muntjac. Elliot was.
"Where have you been?"
he said, when he was done embracing Quentin.
"You ridiculous, ridiculous man. I was starting to think you were dead."
"I was on Earth."
"How long have we been gone? A year and a day?"
"God, it was only 3 days for us." "That makes me 2 years older than you now. How do you think that makes me feel?"
"How was Earth?"
"The same. It ain't Fillory."
"Did you bring me back anything?"
"A bed. Josh. An Australian girl named Poppy. I didn't have a lot of time. And you know how hard you are to shop for." Quentin was still in a euphoric state, but the adrenaline was wearing off, and his eyes felt sandy and jet-lagged. 20 minutes ago it had been midnight, the tail end of a long and arduously alcoholic party, and now it was early afternoon again. They went below to Quentin's cabin, which was now Elliot's cabin, and he dried off and changed clothes and cursed Ember that he hadn't thought to bless Fillory with the miracle of coffee beans. Then he lay down on Elliot's bed and looked up at the low woodwork ceiling and told Elliot about everything that had happened. He told him about going back to Brakebills, and about Julia's safe houses, and how Josh had sold the button. He told him about the Netherlands being in ruins, and about the dragon, and about the Chatwin's house. Elliot sat at the foot of the bed. When Quentin was done, Elliot watched him for a minute, slowly tapping the hollow of his upper lip with the tip of his index finger. "Well," he said finally, "this is interesting." Yes, it was. Although Quentin's immediate personal interest in it was faltering, he wanted to fall asleep and, moreover, felt confident of his ability to do so very quickly. Being back in Fillory was a massive dose of comfort, a huge inflatable cushion of relief of the kind stuntmen fall into from great heights without injury, and he sank into it. Though if Quentin could have had absolutely everything exactly the way he wanted it, he would have asked for one more thing. He didn't want to be on a boat anymore. He wanted to go home, meaning not just to Fillory, but specifically to his room in Castle Whitespire, with its high ceiling and its big bed and its special calm hush. Quentin did not consider himself a great interpreter of signs and wonders, but the lesson of the golden key seemed pretty clear to him. It was this: you've already won the game, so quit playing. Remain where you are, in your castle, and you will be safe. No further action on your part is required. Elliot, he said, where are we?
We're east,
very far east, even farther than you went. We left After Island behind 2 weeks ago. Oh, no. We're over the horizon. No, 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 Quentin closed his eyes. We can't be. He wanted it to be dark, but surly, yellow, late-afternoon sun continued blasting in through his, Elliot's, cabin window unabated. All right, we are. But we're going back now, right? You found me and Julia. Mission accomplished. End of story.
We will go back. We just have to do one more thing first.
Elliot, stop. I'm serious. Turn the ship around. I'm never leaving Fillory again.
Just one thing. You'll like it.
I don't think I'm going to like it. Elliot smiled broadly, or as broadly as his bad teeth would allow. Oh, you're going to love it, he said. It's an adventure. It was unbelievable. Never mind Thomas. He, Quentin, had missed everything. It had started as soon as he left for the outer island. This all came out as a massive feast below decks that evening. By then, Quentin had almost come to accept that when you were surfing the great interdimensional divide, certain days were just destined to stretch out to about 36 hours long, and there was nothing you could do except to wait them out till they ended. The new arrivals ate like wolves. Their exhaustion had turned into a raging hunger. They'd never had a proper dinner the night before, anyway, just the occasional past hors d'oeuvre. Only Julia picked at her food, managing a bite every few minutes, like her body was an unloved pet that she was being forced to babysit.
"I knew something was up," Elliot said, cracking open a massive, lethal-looking crimson crab.
Like Julia, he never seemed to eat, but somehow he got through massive quantities of food anyway, which of course never made him any less skinny. "First off, 2 days after you left Whitespire, someone tried to kill me in my bath."
"Really?"
Josh said with his mouth full.
"And that tipped you off?"
It hadn't taken long for Josh to get acclimated aboard the Muntjac. Discomfort just wasn't in his nature. He'd picked up with Elliot exactly where they'd left off 2 years ago.
"That's awful," Quentin said. "Jesus."
"It was. I was lolling in my bath of an evening, as one does, blameless as a newborn child, more so if you've ever met such a creature. They're absolutely horrible. And one of my own towel boys came creeping up behind me with a big curvy knife in his hand. He tried to cut my throat." "I'll spare you the details," which is what Elliot said when he was going to march you through everything, blow by blow. "But I grabbed his arm and he went in the water. He'd never been a particularly good towel boy. Perhaps he felt he was meant for better things. But he was no great success as an assassin, either, I can tell you. He got his knife against my neck, but nowhere near the artery, and he hadn't braced himself properly at all. So in he went, and I scrambled out of the water, and I froze it.
Dixon's charm?
He nodded. It was no great loss. I was about to get out anyway. I'd put in so many bath salts I didn't know if it would take, but it froze solid right away. He looked like Han Solo frozen in carbonite. The resemblance was actually quite striking.
You and your towel boys, Josh said. But I asked for a harem and it's all morality this, human rights that.
Well, I spared you a good stabbing, didn't I?
Elliot didn't tan. He was too pale for that. But the sun and the wind had put some texture in his otherwise immaculate pallor, and he'd grown some nicely naval stubble. He dropped some of the God-King preciousness that had dominated his persona back at Whitespire, shed some of the gold leaf. He spoke to the crew with an air of easy familiarity and command, even the ones like Bingle, whom he'd never met before the ship sailed, and in Quentin's mind wasn't supposed to know. Now he knew them better than Quentin did. They'd been at sea together for a year. I let him out, of course. I didn't have the heart to let him suffocate. But would you believe it? He wouldn't tell us a thing. He was a fanatic of some kind, or a lunatic, maybe. Same thing. Do you know some of the generals wanted to torture him? I think Janet would have done it, too. But I couldn't. But I couldn't just let him go, either. He's in prison now. I was shaken, but I suppose you're not really High King until somebody tries to kill you in your bath. If they ever succeed, by the way, make sure you leave me in there and have a painting done. Like Marat. I wanted to let the whole thing drop, but I couldn't. It wouldn't let me drop. I don't know what it was. Fillery, I suppose. At any rate, that's when the wonders started. That's what everyone called them. And I couldn't think of another name for them. It started out just as feelings. You would look at something, a carpet or a bowl of fruit, and the colors would seem different, brighter, more vivid, more saturated. Sudden rushes of grief or excitement or love would come over you for no reason. Some very unmanly crying jags were observed among the barons. It was like drugs more than anything else, but I hadn't taken any drugs. I remember one night in my bedroom lying there smelling spices in the darkness, one after the other, cinnamon, jasmine, cardamom, something else, something wonderful I couldn't place. Paintings started to change as I walked by them, just the backgrounds. The clouds would move or the sky would go from day to night. Then I saw a hunting horn hovering before me at dinner. Some of the others saw it too. And one night, in the middle of the night, I opened the bathroom door, and it opened onto deep forest instead. It's all the same when it comes to taking a piss, I suppose, but still, it put me right off my game. For a while, I thought I was going mad, literally mad, until the tree came. A clock tree grew up right in the middle of the throne room, right through the carpet, in broad daylight. It did it all at once, all in one go, with the whole court watching. And then it just stood there, silently, like a hallucination, ticking and sort of swaying with the energy of its just having grown. It was as if it were saying, "Well, here I am. This is me. What are you going to do about it?" After that, I knew it wasn't me that had gone mad. It was Fillory. I don't mind telling you I found the whole business more than a little provoking. I was being called, you understand, and I most definitely did not want to come. I understand the appeal this sort of thing has for you, quests and King Arthur and all that, but that's you. No offense, but it always seemed a bit like boy stuff to me, sweaty and strenuous and just not very elegant, if you see what I mean. I didn't need to be called to feel special. I feel special enough already. I'm clever, rich, and good-looking. I was perfectly happy where I was, deliquescing atom by atom amid a riot of luxury.
"Nicely put," Quentin said. "Elliot must have mounted this set-piece before."
"Well, and then that damned seeing hare came bolting through the room during our afternoon meeting.
scatter the whiskey service and frightened one of my more sensitive protégés half to death. Everyone has a limit. Next morning I called for my hunting leathers, saddled a horse, and went riding out alone into the Queenswood. And you know, I never go anywhere alone, not anymore. But these things have certain protocols, and not even the High King, or I suppose especially not the High King, is exempt.
The Queenswood, Quentin said. Don't tell me.
But I am telling you. Elliot finished his wine, and a rangy, shaven-headed young man refilled his glass without his having to ask. I went back to that ridiculous meadow of yours, the round one. You see, you'd been right to want to go in. It was our adventure, after all.
I was right.
Quentin felt crestfallen. He stared down at his hands. I can't believe it. I was right. If he hadn't been so tired and a bit drunk, it probably wouldn't have struck him the way it did. But as it was, he felt himself filling up with a sense of, how could he put it? He thought he'd learned a lesson about the world, and now he was realizing that the lesson he learned might have been the wrong one. The right adventure had been offered to him, and he'd walked away. If being a hero is a matter of knowing your cues, like the fairy tales said, he'd missed his. Instead, he'd spent 3 days faffing around on Earth for nothing and nearly got stuck there forever while Elliot was off on a real quest.
It's true, Elliot said.
Statistically, historically, and however else you want to look at it, you are almost never right. A monkey making life decisions based on its horoscope in USA Today would be right more often than you. But in this case, yes, you were right. Don't spoil it.
It was supposed to be me, not you.
You should have gone on it when you had the chance.
You told me not to.
Janet told you not to. I don't know why you listened to her.
But look,
I know, Elliot put a hand on his arm, I know. I had no choice. Whoever is in charge of handing out quests has a damn peculiar sense of humor. At any rate, off I went, and I did feel something, you know, as I set off that morning. Nip in the air, sun on my armor, a knight pricking across the plain. I wished you could have been there, though I looked much better than you would have. I had special questing armor made just for that day, embossed and damascened within an inch of its life. I won't lie to you, Quentin. I looked magnificent.
Quentin wondered what he'd been doing at that moment. At least he'd gotten to drink a Coke. That was something. He wished he had one now. He was exhausted.
It took me 3 days to find that fucking meadow, but I finally did. The Seeing Hare was there, of course, waiting for me under the branches of that hideous great tree, which was still thrashing away in its invisible wind.
Intangible. Poppy said in a small voice. All wind is invisible.
Good to see she was finding her feet. The hare wasn't alone. The bird was there as well, and the monitor, the utter newt, the kind wolf, the parallel beetle. It does a geometrical thing. It's so boring I can't even explain it. All of them, all the unique beasts, the full conclave, well, except the two aquatic ones. The questing beast sends you his regards, by the way. I think he's fond of you for some reason, even though you shot him. Well, when I saw them all there together, standing in two neat rows, the little ones in front like they were posing for a class picture, I knew the jig was up. It was the newt that did the talking. He let it be known that the realm was in peril, and nothing else would do but my recovering the 7 golden keys of Fillory. I asked him why, what good were they, what were they for, what did they unlock? He wouldn't say, or he couldn't. He said I would know when it was time. I haggled a bit, of course. I wanted to know, for example, how rapidly these keys would have to be recovered. I could imagine doing one every few years, organize my holidays around it. At that rate, I might even look forward to it. It's always nicer traveling when you have some business to do. But apparently it's a time-sensitive issue. They were very insistent about that. They gave me a golden ring that the keys were supposed to go on, and I left. What else could I do? When I got back, Whitespire was up in arms. There were all kinds of terrible portents all over the kingdom. That storm had spread. All the clock trees had started thrashing the way that first one did. And you know the waterfall at the Red Ruin, the one that flows up? It started flowing down. You know, the regular way. So that was about the last straw. And then the Muntjac came screaming into port, and they told me you and Julia had vanished. In full hero mode, Elliot took command of the Muntjac. He spent a day repairing and provisioning it while the whole kingdom buzzed with anxiety and excitement. High King Elliot was going on a quest. Apart from everything else, it was a public relations triumph. The docks were mobbed by volunteers offering to join the search for the seven keys. The dwarves sent over a trunkload of magical keys they happened to have been kicking around in their vaults in case there was a match in there, but most of them turned out to be useless. One, though, fit on the key ring. So, six to go. Funny how every once in a while the dwarves came up trumps. Elliot left Janet in sole possession of the castle. He felt bad about making her shoulder everything, even more than she already did, but she was practically licking her chops as he left. She would probably be running a fascist dictatorship by the time they got back, so he set off. Elliot had no idea where he was going, but he'd read enough to know that a state of relative ignorance wasn't necessarily a handicap on a quest. It was something your dauntless questing knight accepted and embraced. You lit out into the wilderness at random, and if your state of mind, or maybe it was your soul, was correct, then adventure would find you through the natural course of events. It was like free association. There were no wrong answers. It worked as long as you weren't trying too hard. And Elliot was in no danger of trying too hard. The Muntjac ran fast before a warm, wet wind out past the outer island, and after, out of Fillory and out of the known world. A hush settled over the table. For a moment, the creaking of the ship's ropes and timbers could be heard, and Quentin felt for the first time how far off the map they were. He thought how they would look to someone far above them, a tiny, lighted ship, lost in the immensity of an empty, uncharted, nighttime ocean. Elliot studied the ceiling. He was actually groping for words. That was a new one on Quentin. "You wouldn't have believed it, Q," he said finally. Something like an expression of actual awe had come over Elliot's face. "You really wouldn't. We've been all over the Eastern Ocean, the lands we saw, some of the islands. I don't know where to begin." "Tell him about the train," said the shaven-headed young man. All at once, Quentin recognized him. It was Benedict, but a new Benedict, reborn with ropey muscles and flashing white teeth. The floppy bangs and the sullen attitude were long gone. He looked at Elliot with a respect Quentin had never seen him show anybody before. "Yes, the train. We thought it was a sea serpent at first. We barely brought the ship around in time, but it was a train, one of those slow freight trains that are always about a million cars long, all tankers and boxcars, except that this one never ended. It broke the surface, seawater streaming off the sides of the cars, rumbled along beside us for a couple of miles, then it sank back under the sea again."
"Just like that?"
"Just like that. Bingle hopped onto it for a while, but we could never get any of the cars open. And we found a castle floating on the ocean. At first, we just heard it, bells ringing in the middle of the night. The next morning, we came up on it, a stone castle riding on a fleet of groaning wooden barges. No one inside, just bells tolling in one of the towers with the rocking of the waves. What else? There was an island where no one could tell a lie. Goodness, that was awkward for a while. We aired a lot of dirty laundry there, I can tell you." Rueful smiles went around the room among the crew. "There was one where the people were really waves,
ocean waves, which I know, but I just can't explain it more than that. There was a place where the ocean poured into a huge chasm, and there was only a narrow bridge across it, a water bridge that we had to sail across.
Like an aqueduct, Benedict put in.
Like an aqueduct. It was all so strange. I think magic gets magnified out here, gets wilder, and it creates all sorts of impossible places all by itself. We spent a week trapped in the doldrums. There was no wind, and the water was as smooth as glass, and there was a Sargasso Sea there, a big swirl of flotsam in the ocean. People lived there, picking through it. Everything people forget about ends up there one day, they said. Toys, tables, whole houses. And people end up there, too. They get forgotten as well. We were almost trapped there, but the Muntjac sprouted a bank of oars to help us get away. Didn't you, old thing? Elliot knocked familiarly on the bulkhead with his fist. You could take things away with you from the Sargasso Sea, but you had to leave something behind. That was the deal. Bingle took a magic sword. Show them your sword, Bing. Bingle, sitting at the far end of the table, stood up and drew his sword halfway out of its sheath, almost shyly. It was a narrow length of bright steel, chased with swirly silver patterns that glowed white. He won't say what he left behind for it.
What did you leave, Bingle?
Bingle smiled and touched the side of his nose and said nothing. Quentin was weary. He'd woken up in Venice that morning and spent the day in England and another half-day in Fillory. He'd already been drunk once and sobered up, and now he was getting drunk again, sitting there on a hard, splintery bench in the Muntjac's galley. Probably Elliot would have enjoyed a little jaunt back to Earth, he thought, where the wine and coffee were better. Though, who knows, maybe it wouldn't have worked if it had been the other way around. Maybe he couldn't have done it. Maybe he would have gotten trapped in the Sargasso Sea, and maybe Elliot wouldn't have found his way to Josh, and wouldn't have gone to see the dragon, wouldn't have played with Thomas. Maybe he would have failed where Quentin succeeded, and vice versa. Maybe this was the only way it could have gone. You didn't get the quest you wanted. You got the one you could do. That was the hard part, accepting that you didn't get to choose which way you went. Except, of course, he had chosen. "Don't keep us in suspense," he said. "Did you find the keys?" Elliot nodded. "We found some of them. It was always either a fight or a riddle, one or the other. One was a huge beast, like a giant spiny lobster. It had the key inside its heart. Then there was a beach that was all made of keys, millions of them, and we had to go through them till we found the right one. There was probably a trick to that one, but no one could think what it was, so we brute-forced it instead, took shifts, trying keys on the key ring, round the clock. After a couple of weeks, we got a fit. Now, I'm sorry if I'm a bit direct about this, but you have to remember we've been at this for a full year, week in and week out, and frankly, all this questing is wearing pretty thin. So here it is. We have 5 of the 7 keys. 1 the dwarves gave us, and 4 we found. Do you have one? The one from After Island? No, Quentin said. Julia and I left it behind when we went through the door. Didn't somebody take it? Quentin looked at Bingle, then at Benedict. Neither one of them met his eye. No, but we don't have it either. Damn, Elliot said. That's what I was afraid of. But what happened? It can't just have disappeared. It must still be on After Island. It's not, Benedict said. We looked everywhere. Well, we'll just have to keep looking, Elliot sighed and raised his glass to be refilled. So it looks like you're going to see some adventuring after all.
Chapter 18. The house in Bed-Stuy was Julia's first safe house, and it was the end of Stanford. She was never going to college now. It was her parents' hearts, broken for the second and final time. It was too terrible to think about, so she dealt with it by not thinking about it. She could have said no, of course. She could have finished dialing the number of the car service and turned her back on the man with the pork pie hat and waited till the black town car came and gotten in and repeated her home address to the Guatemalan Highlander behind the wheel until he finally understood and whisked her away from it all. Or she couldn't have, but she wished she could. She wished it then, and she would re-wish it many times in the years to come. But she couldn't walk away because the dream of magic, wasn't dead. She'd tried to kill it, to beat the life out of it with work and drugs and therapy and family and the free traders, but she couldn't. It was stronger than she was. The owlish young man who was working the door of the Bed-Stuy safe house that night was named Jared. He was about 30, not tall, with a bright smile and heavy black stubble and heavy black glasses. He'd been working on a doctorate in linguistics at NYU for the past 9 years. Nights and weekends, he worked magic. They weren't all like that, nerdy, academic, what you'd think. It was a surprisingly heterogeneous crowd. There was a 12-year-old prodigy from the neighborhood, and a 65-year-old widow who drove down from Westchester County in a BMW SUV on weekends. In all, there was a rotating cast of about 25, physicists and receptionists and pipe fitters and musicians and undergrads and hedge fund guys and barely functional, socially marginal nut jobs. And now there was Julia. Some of them came in once a month to work on spells, and some of them showed up at 6 in the morning every morning and stayed till 10 at night or slept there, though house rules kept that to a minimum. Some of them were high-functioning in their daily lives, had careers and families, and no obvious signs of eccentricity or physical debilitation. But doing magic alongside all that other stuff was a tricky balancing act, and when you lost it and fell, you hit the floor hard. Even if you got up again, you got up limping, and everybody fell sooner or later. See, when you had magic in your life, it turned out, when you lived the double life of a secret underground magician, you paid a certain price, which was that your secret other life pulled at you always. Your magician self, that loopy doppelganger, was always with you, tugging at your sleeve, whispering silently that your real life was a fake life, a crude and undignified and inauthentic charade that nobody was really buying anyway. Your real self, the one that mattered, was the other one, the one waving her hands around and chanting in a dead Slavic dialect on the busted-ass couch in the lime-green clabbered house on Troop Avenue. Julia kept her job, but she was at the house most nights and all day on weekends. The lust was back, and this time it looked like she could slake it. She had the scent, and she was going to make the kill. She went quiet on FTB. The free traders could wait. They were used to members dropping off the grid unexpectedly for months or years at a time. In the chronic mood disorder community, that was well within normal operating parameters. As for her parents, Julia cut herself off. She knew what she was doing. She knew how hard it would be for them, watching her fall back into the obsession and get skinny again and stop bathing and all the rest of it. And she did it anyway. She felt like she had no choice. It was an addiction. Thinking about the consequences for her family, really thinking about them, would have annihilated her with remorse. So she didn't. The first morning, she caught herself absent-mindedly, almost sensuously, running a thumbnail along her arm at the breakfast table, leaving a red line behind, or rather, when she caught her mother catching her doing it, no words were spoken. But she saw part of her mother die that morning, and Julia did not take heroic measures to resuscitate her. Julia could have died that morning, too, she knew. She almost did. But you let a drowning woman cling to you. She'll drag you down with her. And what's the point of that? That's what she told herself, anyway. You have to look her in the eye and pry her fingers off your arm and watch her sink down into the airless green depths and perish there. It's either that or you'll both die.
What's the point? Her sister knew that. You could see the disappointment in her quick, brown, foxy eyes. Then you could see it change and harden into something clear and smooth and protective. She was young enough. She could still swerve around the wreck and keep moving. She let Julia go, her sister with her black secrets. Smart kid. She had made a sensible deal. Julia made one, too. And what did Julia get for her deal? When you put your family and your heart and your life and your future up on the block, how much does that net you? What do you walk away with in return? Show her what she's won, Bob.
A lot, it turns out. A motherfucking load of arcane lore is what it gets you for starters. That first day, they tested her. From the second you got in the door, Jared actually started up the stopwatch widget on his iPhone as she crossed the threshold. You had 15 minutes to learn and execute the flash spell that Quentin punted at the Winston safe house, or you had to leave, and you couldn't come back for a month. They called it, boringly, the first flash. You could try again at another safe house, of course. They didn't share information. But there were only two in New York City, so if you wanted to get your magic on in the five boroughs, you had to go big or go home. Tired as she was, Julia did it in 8 minutes flat. If she'd had any muscle tone left over from her rainbow witch phase, she wouldn't even have needed that long. As it turned out, they didn't know the rainbow spell, so she printed out the scan she'd downloaded from the internet that one time. It was already 2 years ago now, and brought it in. Jared, the linguist, with great pomp and ceremony, encased it in a transparent plastic sleeve, punched the sleeve with a three-hole punch, and added it to a tatty, duct-taped three-ring binder in which they kept the club's spell list. A three-ring binder. That's what they had by way of a spell book. And they called it the spell binder. That should have tipped Julia off. Still, it increased 20-fold the sum of Julia's information about magic, and that was a joy beyond measuring. Under Jared's tutelage, or whoever the senior magician in the house on any given day happened to be, she worked her way through the book. She learned how to stick things together with magic. She learned how to light a fire at a distance. She learned a spell to guess a coin flip, and to keep a nail from rusting, and to take a magnetic charge off a magnet. They competed with each other to see how many everyday tasks they could do with magic, opening jars, tying their shoes, buttoning buttons. It was a bit random, and it was a bit small potatoes, but it was a start. Nail by nail, magnet by magnet, she began to force the world to conform to her specifications. Magic. It was what happened when the mind met the world, and the mind won for a change. There was another binder of hand exercises, much battered from having been thrown across the room in frustration, and she started work on them, too. Soon she had the book memorized, and she did the exercises all the time, in the shower, under the table at mealtimes, under her desk at work, at night as she lay in bed. And she got serious about her languages. Magic wasn't just a math thing, it turned out. As she learned spells, she gained levels. Yes, levels, that's what they called them. The lameness of the level system, borrowed wholesale from Dungeons and Dragons, which must have borrowed it from Freemasonry, she supposed, was not deniable, but it did keep things orderly, and it kept the hierarchies clearly defined, which Julia liked more and more the higher she rose in them. She began the tattoos on her back. She took care to leave a lot of room because she was learning fast. It took her a month to realize that she was learning faster than the other regulars at the safe house, and another 3 months to realize just how much faster. By that point, she had 7 stars, which was as many as Jared had, and he'd been at it for 3 years. Probably at Break Bills she would have been just another apprentice, but she wasn't at Break Bills, was she? She was here, and here she stood out. The others just didn't seem to have any flair for the theoretical side of magic. They learned their spells by rote, but they weren't interested in the basic patterns that underlay them.
Only a few of them went into the deeper linguistic work, the grammars and the root systems. They preferred to just memorize the syllables and gestures and forget the rest. They were wrong. It sapped the power of their casting, and it meant that every time they